Welcome to Thrilling Tales of Adventure. I'm Mordell, and our next story is by Raphael Sabatini from A Historical Night's Entertainment, Volume 1, The Night of Escape. Patrician influence from without had procured Casanova's removal in August of that year, 1756, from the loathsome cell he had occupied for 13 months in the Piombi, so called from the leaded roof immediately above those prisons, which are simply the garrets of the Doge's palace. That cell had been no better than a kennel, seldom reached by light of day, and so shallow that it was impossible for a man of his fine height to stand upright in it. But his present prison was comparatively spacious, and it was airy and well lighted by a barred window whence he could see the Lido. Yet he was desperately chagrined at the change, for he had almost completed his arrangements to break out of his former cell. The only ray of hope in his present despair came from the fact that the implement to which he trusted was still in his possession, safely concealed in the upholstery of the armchair that had been moved with him into his present quarters. That implement he had fashioned for himself with infinite pains out of a door bolt some 20 inches long, which he had found discarded in a rubbish heap in a corner of the attic where he had been allowed to take his brief daily exercise. Using as a whetstone a small slab of black marble similarly acquired, he had shaped that bolt into a sharp octagonal pointed chisel, or spontoon. It remained in his possession, but he saw no chance of using it now, for the suspicions of Lorenzo the gaoler were aroused, and daily a couple of archers came to sound the floors and walls. True, they did not sound the ceiling, which was low and within reach, but it was obviously impossible to cut through the ceiling in such a manner as to leave the progress of the work unseen. Hence his despair of breaking out of a prison where he had spent over a year without trial or prospect of a trial, and where he seemed likely to spend the remainder of his days. He did not know precisely why he had been arrested. All that Giacomo Casanova knew was that he was accounted a disturber of the public peace. He was notoriously a libertine, a gamester, and heavily in debt. Also, and this was more serious, he was accused of practicing magic, as indeed he had done, as a means of exploiting to his own profit the credulity of simpletons of all degrees. He would have explained to the inquisitors of state, of the most serene republic, that the books of magic found by their apparitors in his possession, the Clavicula of Solomon, the Zecor Ben, and other kindred works, had been collected by him as a curious instances of human aberration. But the inquisitors of state would not have believed him, for the inquisitors were among those who took magic seriously. And anyhow, they had never asked him to explain, but had left him as if forgotten in that abominable verminous cell under the leads, until his patrician friend had obtained him the mercy of this transfer to better quarters. This Casanova was a man of iron nerve and iron constitution. Tall and well made, he was boldly handsome, with fine dark eyes and dark brown hair. In age he was barely 21, but he looked older, as well he might, for in his adventurer's way he had already gathered more experience of life than most men gain in half a century. The same influence that had obtained him his change of cell had also gained him latterly the privilege, and he esteemed it beyond all else, of procuring himself books. Desiring the works of the Maffei, he bade his gaoler purchase them out of the allowance made him by the inquisitors, in accordance with the Venetian custom. This allowance was graduated to the social status of each prisoner. But the books being costly, and any monthly surplus from his monthly expenditure being usually the gaoler's perquisite, Lorenzo was reluctant to indulge him. He mentioned that there was a prisoner above who was well equipped with books, and who no doubt would be glad to lend in exchange. Yielding to the suggestion, Casanova handed Lorenzo a copy of Pitot's Rationarium and received next morning in exchange the first volume of Wolfe. Within he found a sheet bearing in 6 verses a paraphrase of Seneca's epigram, Calamitosus et Amatus Futuri Anxius. Immediately he perceived he had stumbled upon a means of corresponding with one who might be disposed to assist him to break prison. In reply, being a scholarly rascal, he had been educated for the priesthood. He wrote 6 verses himself, having no pen. He cut the long nail of his little finger to a point, and splitting it, supplied the want. For ink he used the juice of mulberries. In addition to the verses, he wrote a list of the books in his possession, which he placed at the disposal of his fellow captive. He concealed the written sheet in the spine of that vellum-bound volume, and on the title page, in warning of this, he wrote the single Latin word, latet. Next morning he handed the book to Lorenzo, telling him that he had read it, and requesting the second volume. That second volume came on the next day, and in the spine of it, a long letter, some sheets of paper, pens, and a pencil. The writer announced himself as one Marino Balbi, a patrician and a monk, who had been 4 years in that prison, where he had since been given a companion in misfortune, Count Andrea Asquino. Thus began a regular and very full correspondence between the prisoners, and soon Casanova, who had not lived on his wits for nothing, was able to form a shrewd estimate of Balbi's character. The monk's letters revealed it as compounded of sensuality, stupidity, ingratitude, and indiscretion. In the world, says Casanova, I should have had no commerce with a fellow of his nature, but in the Piombi I was obliged to make capital out of everything that came under my hands. The capital he desired to make in this instance was to ascertain whether Balbi would be disposed to do for him what he could not do for himself. He wrote inquiring and proposing flight. Balbi replied that he and his companion would do anything possible to make their escape from that abominable prison, but his lack of resource made him add that he was convinced that nothing was possible. All that you have to do, wrote Casanova in answer, is to break through the ceiling of my cell and get me out of this, then trust to me to get you out of the Piombi. If you are disposed to make the attempt, I will supply you with the means and show you the way. It was a characteristically bold reply, revealing to us the utter gamester that he was in all things. He knew that Balbi's cell was situated immediately under the leads, and he hoped that once in it he should be able readily to find a way through the roof. That cell of Balbi's communicated with a narrow corridor, no more than a shaft for light and air, which was immediately above Casanova's prison. And no sooner had Balbi written consenting than Casanova explained what was to do. Balbi must break through the wall of his cell into the little corridor, and there cut a round hole in the floor, precisely as Casanova had done in his former cell, until nothing but a shell of ceiling remained. A shell that could be broken down by 6 blows when the moment to escape should have arrived. To begin with, he ordered Balbi to purchase himself 2 or 3 dozen pictures of saints, with which to paper his walls, using as many as might be necessary for a screen to hide the hole he would be cutting. When Balbi wrote that his walls were hung with pictures of saints, it became a question of conveying the spontoon to him. This was difficult, and the monk's fatuous suggestions merely served further to reveal his stupidity. Finally, Casanova's wits found the way. He bade Lorenzo to buy him an in-folio edition of the Bible, which had just been published, and it was into the spine of this enormous tome that he packed the precious spontoon and thus conveyed it to Balbi, who immediately got to work. This was at the commencement of October. On the 8th of that month, Balbi wrote to Casanova that a whole night devoted to labor had resulted merely in the displacing of a single brick, which so discouraged the faint-hearted monk that he was for abandoning an attempt whose only result must be to increase in the future the rigor of their confinement. Without hesitation, Casanova replied that he was assured of success, although he was far from having any grounds for any such assurance. He enjoined the monk to believe him and to persevere, confident that as he advanced he would find progress easier. This proved indeed to be the case, for soon Balbi found the brickwork yielding so rapidly to his efforts that one morning a week later, Casanova heard 3 light taps above his head, the preconcerted signal by which they were to assure themselves that their notions of the topography of the prison were correct. All that day he heard Balbi at work immediately above him, and again on the morrow when Balbi wrote that as the floor was of the thickness of only 2 boards, he counted upon completing the job on the next day without piercing the ceiling. But it would seem as if fortune were intent upon making a mock of Casanova, luring him to heights of hope, merely to cast him down again into the depths of despair. Just as the eve of breaking out of his former cell, mischance had thwarted him, so now, when again he deemed himself upon the very threshold of liberty, came mischance again to thwart him. Early in the afternoon, the sound of bolts being drawn outside froze his very blood and checked his breathing. Yet he had the presence of mind to give the double knock that was the agreed alarm signal, whereupon Balbi instantly desisted from his labors overhead. Came Lorenzo with 2 archers, leading an ugly, lean little man of between 40 and 50 years of age, shabbily dressed and wearing a round black wig, whom the tribunal had ordered should share Casanova's prison for the present. With apologies for leaving such a scoundrel in Casanova's company, Lorenzo departed, and the newcomer went down upon his knees, drew forth a chaplet, and began to tell his beads. Casanova surveyed this intruder at once with disgust and despair. Presently his disgust was increased when the fellow, whose name was Scoradisi, frankly avowed himself a spy in the service of the Council of 10, a calling which he warmly defended from the contempt, universally but unjustly accorded to himself, made it out to it. He had been imprisoned for having failed in his duty on one occasion, through succumbing to a bribe. Conceive Casanova's frame of mind, his uncertainty as to how long this monster, as he calls him, might be left in his company, his curbed impatience to regain his liberty, and his consciousness of the horrible risk of discovery which delay entailed. He wrote to Balbi that night while the spy slept, and for the present their operations were suspended. But not for very long. Soon Casanova's wits resolved how to turn to account the weakness which he discovered in Soradisi. The spy was devout to the point of bigoted, credulous superstition. He spent long hours in prayer, and he talked freely of his special devotion to the Blessed Virgin and his ardent faith in miracles. Casanova, the arch humbug who had worked magic to delude the credulous, determined there and then to work a miracle for Soradici. Assuming an inspired air, he solemnly informed the spy one morning that it had been revealed to him in a dream that Soradici's devotion to the rosary was about to be rewarded, that an angel was to be sent from heaven to deliver him from prison, and that Casanova himself would accompany him in his flight. If Soradici doubted, conviction was soon to follow, for Casanova foretold the very hour at which the angel would come to break into the prison, and at that hour precisely, Casanova, having warned Balbi, the noise made by the angel overhead flung Soradici into an ecstasy of terror. But when at the end of 4 hours the angel desisted from his labors, Soradici was beset by doubts. Casanova explained to him that since angels invariably put on the garb of human flesh, when descending to earth, they labor under human difficulties. He added the prophecy that the angel would return on the last day of the month, the eve of All Saints, 2 days later, and that he would then conduct them out of captivity. By this means, Casanova ensured that no betrayal should be feared from the thoroughly duped Soradici, who now spent the time in praying, weeping, and talking of his sins and of the inexhaustibility of divine grace. To make doubly sure, Casanova added the most terrible oath that if, by a word to the gaoler, Soradici should presume to frustrate the divine intentions, he would immediately strangle him with his own hands. On October 31st, Lorenzo paid his usual daily visit early in the morning. After his departure, they waited some hours, Soradici in expectant terror, Casanova in sheer impatience to be at work. Promptly at noon fell heavy blows overhead, and then, in a cloud of plaster and broken lathes, the heavenly messenger descended clumsily into Casanova's arms. Soradici found this tall, gaunt, bearded figure clad in a dirty shirt and a pair of leather breeches, of a singularly unangelic appearance. Indeed, he looked far more like a devil. When he produced a pair of scissors, so that the spy might cut Casanova's beard, which, like the angel's, had grown in captivity, Soradici ceased to have any illusions on the score of Balbi's celestial nature, although still intrigued, since he could not guess at the secret correspondence that had passed between Casanova and Balbi. He perceived quite clearly that he had been fooled. Leaving Soradici in the monk's care, Casanova hoisted himself through the broken ceiling and gained Balbi's cell, where the sight of Count Aquino dismayed him. He found a middle-aged man of a corpulence which must render it impossible for him to face the athletic difficulties that lay before them. Of this the Count himself seemed already persuaded. "If you think," was his greeting as he shook Casanova's hand, "to break through the roof and find a way down from the leads, I don't see how you're going to succeed without wings. I have not the courage to accompany you," he added. "I shall remain and pray for you." Attempting no persuasions where they must have been idle, Casanova passed out of the cell again, and approaching as nearly as possible to the edge of the attic, he sat down where he could touch the roof as it sloped immediately above his head. With his spontoon, he tested the timbers and found them so decayed that they almost crumbled at the touch. Assured thereby that the cutting of a hole would be an easy matter, he at once returned to his cell, and there he spent the ensuing 4 hours in preparing ropes. He cut up sheets, blankets, coverlets, and the very core of his mattress, knotting the strips together with the utmost care. In the end, he found himself equipped with some 200 yards of rope, which should be ample for any purpose. Having made a bundle of the fine taffeta suit in which he had been arrested, his gay cloak of floss silk, some stocking shirts and handkerchiefs, he and Balbi passed up to the other cell, compelling Soradici to go with them. Leaving the monk to make a parcel of his belongings, Casanova went to tackle the roof. By dusk he had made a hole twice as large as was necessary, and had laid bare the lead sheeting with which the roof was covered. Unable single-handed to raise one of the sheets, he called to Balbi to his aid, and between them, assisted by the spontoon, which Casanova inserted between the edge of the sheet and the gutter, they at last succeeded in tearing away the rivets. Then by putting their shoulders to the lead, they bent it upwards until there was room to emerge, and a view of the sky flooded by the vivid light of the crescent moon. Not daring in that light to venture upon the roof, where they would be seen, they must wait with what patience they could until midnight, when the moon would have set. So they returned to the cell where they had left Soradici with Count Esquino. From Balbi, Casanova had learnt that Esquino, though well supplied with money, was of an avaricious nature. Nevertheless, since money would be necessary, Casanova asked the Count for the loan of 30 gold sequins. Esquino answered him gently that in the first place they would not need money to escape, that in the second he had a numerous family, that in the third, if Casanova perished, the money would be lost, and that in the fourth, he had no money. "My reply," writes Casanova, "lasted half an hour. Let me remind you," he said in concluding his exhortation, "of your promise to pray for us, and let me ask you what sense there can be in praying for the success of an enterprise to which you refuse to contribute the most necessary means." The old man was so far conquered by Casanova's eloquence that he offered him 2 sequins, which Casanova accepted, since he was not in case to refuse anything. Thereafter, as they sat, waiting for the moon to set, Casanova found his earlier estimate of the monk's character confirmed. Balbi now broke into abusive reproaches. He found that Casanova had acted in bad faith by assuring him that he had formed a complete plan of escape. Had he suspected that this was a mere gambler's throw on Casanova's part, he would never have labored to get him out of his cell. The Count added his advice that they should abandon an attempt foredoomed to failure, and being concerned for the 2 sequins which he had so reluctantly parted, he argued the case at great length. Stifling his disgust, Casanova assured them that, although it was impossible for him to afford them details of how he intended to proceed, he was perfectly confident of success. At 10:30, he sent Soradici, who had remained silent throughout, to report upon the night. The spy brought word that in another hour or so the moon would have set, but that a thick mist was rising which must render the leads very dangerous. "So long as the mist isn't made of oil, I am content," said Casanova. "Come, make a bundle of your cloak. It is time we were moving." But at this, Soradici fell on his knees in the dark, seized Casanova's hands, and begged to be left behind to pray for their safety, since he would be sure to meet his death if he attempted to go with them. Casanova assented readily, delighted to be rid of the fellow. Then in the dark he wrote as best he could a quite characteristic letter to the inquisitors of state, in which he took his leave of them, telling them that since he had been fetched into the prison without his wishes being consulted, they could not complain that he should depart without consulting theirs. The bundle containing Balbi's clothes and another made up of 1/2 the rope he slung from the monk's neck, thereafter doing the same in his own case. Then in their shirt sleeves, their hats on their heads, the pair of them started on their perilous journey. leaving Count Asquino and Soradici to pray for them. Casanova went first on all fours, and thrusting the point of his spontoon between the joints of the lead sheeting so as to obtain a hold, he crawled slowly upwards. To follow, Balbi took a grip of Casanova's belt with his right hand, so that in addition to making his own way, Casanova was compelled to drag the weight of his companion after him, and this up the sharp gradient of a roof rendered slippery by the mist. Midway in that laborious ascent, the monk called to him to stop. He had dropped the bundle containing the clothes, and he hoped that it had not rolled beyond the gutter, though he did not mention which of them should retrieve it. After the unreasonableness already endured from this man, Casanova's exasperation was such in a moment that he confesses he was tempted to kick him after this bundle. Controlling himself, however, he answered patiently that the matter could not now be helped, and kept steadily amain. At last, the apex of the roof was reached, and they got astride of it to breathe and to take a survey of their surroundings. They faced several cupolas of the Church of St. Mark, which is connected with the ducal palace, being in fact no more than the private chapel of the Doge. They set down their bundles, and of course, in the act of doing so, the wretched Balbi must lose his hat and send it rolling down the roof after the bundle he had already lost. He cried out that it was an evil omen. On the contrary, Casanova assured him patiently, it is a sign of divine protection, for if your bundle or your hat had happened to roll to the left instead of the right, it would have fallen into the courtyard, where it would be seen by the guards, who must conclude that someone is moving on the roof, and so, no doubt, would have discovered us. As it is, your hat has followed your bundle into the canal, where it can do no harm. Thereupon, bidding the monk to await his return, Casanova set off alone on a voyage of discovery, keeping for the present astride of the roof in his progress. He spent a full hour wandering along the vast roof, going to right and to left in his quest, but failing completely to make any helpful discovery, or to find anything to which he could attach a rope. In the end, it began to look as if, after all, he must choose between returning to prison and flinging himself from the roof into the canal. He was almost in despair when, in his wanderings, his attention was caught by a dormer window on the canal side, about two-thirds of the way down the slope of the roof. With infinite precaution, he lowered himself down the steep, slippery incline until he was astride of the little dormer roof. Leaning well forward, he discovered that a slender grating barred the lidded panes of the window itself, and for a moment this grating gave him pause. Midnight boomed just then from the Church of St. Mark, like a reminder that but 7 hours remained in which to conquer this and further difficulties that might confront him, and in which to win clear of that place, or else submit to a resumption of his imprisonment, under conditions, no doubt, 100-fold more rigorous. Lying flat on his stomach, and hanging far over, so as to see what he was doing, he worked one point of his spontoon into the sash of the grating, and levering outwards, he strained until at last it came away completely in his hands. After that, it was an easy matter to shatter the little latticed window. Having accomplished so much, he turned and, using his spontoon as before, he crawled back to the summit of the roof and made his way rapidly along this to the spot where he had left Balbi. The monk, reduced by now to a state of blending despair, terror, and rage, greeted Casanova in terms of the grossest abuse for having left him there so long. "I was waiting only for daylight," he concluded, "to return to prison." "What did you think had become of me?" asked Casanova, I imagine that you had tumbled off the roof. And is this abuse the expression of your joy at finding yourself mistaken? Where have you been all this time? The monk counter-questioned sullenly. Come with me, and you shall see. And taking up his bundle again, Casanova led his companion forward until they were in line with the dormer. There Casanova showed him what he had done and consulted him as to the means to be adopted to enter the attic. It would be too risky for them to allow themselves to drop from the sill, since the height of the window from the floor was unknown to them and might be considerable. It would be easy for one of them to lower the other by means of the rope, but it was not apparent how hereafter the other was to follow, thus reasoned Casanova.
You'd better lower me anyhow, said Balbi without hesitation, for no doubt he was very tired of that slippery roof, on which a single false step might have sent him to his account.
Once I am inside, you can consider ways of following me. That cold-blooded expression of the fellow's egoism put Casanova in a rage for the second time since they had left their prison. But as before, he conquered it, and without uttering a word, he proceeded to unfasten the coil of rope. Making one end of it secure under Balbi's arms, he bade the monk lie prone upon the roof, his feet pointing downwards, and then paying out the rope, he lowered him to the dormer. He then bade him get through the window as far as the level of his waist, and wait thus, hanging over and supporting himself upon the sill. When he had obeyed, Casanova followed, sliding carefully down the roof of the dormer. Planting himself firmly and taking the rope once more, he bade Balbi to let himself go without fear, and so lowered him to the floor. A height from the window, as it proved, of some 50 feet. This extinguished all Casanova's hopes of being able to follow by allowing himself to drop from the sill. He was dismayed, but the monk, happy to find himself at last off that accursed roof and out of all danger of breaking his neck, called foolishly to Casanova to throw him the rope so that he might take care of it. As may be imagined, says Casanova, I was careful not to take this idiotic advice. Not knowing now what was to become of him, unless he could discover some other means than those at his command, he climbed back again to the summit of the roof and started off desperately upon another voyage of discovery. This time he succeeded better than before. He found about a cupola a terrace which he had not earlier noticed, and on this terrace a hod of plaster, a trowel, and a ladder some 70 feet long. He saw his difficulties solved. He passed an end of rope about one of the rungs, laid the ladder flat along the slope of the roof, and then, still astride of the apex, he worked his way back, dragging the ladder with him, until he was once more on a level with the dormer. But now, the difficulty was how to get the ladder through the window, and he had cause to repent having so hastily deprived himself of his companion's assistance. He had got the ladder into position and lowered it until one of its ends rested upon the dormer, whilst the other projected some 20 feet beyond the edge of the roof. He slid down to the dormer and, placing the ladder beside him, drew it up so that he could reach the 8th rung. To this rung he made fast his rope, then lowered the ladder again until the upper end of it was in line with the window through which he sought to introduce it. But he found it impossible to do so beyond the 5th rung, for at this point the end of the ladder came into contact with the roof inside and could be pushed no farther until it was inclined downward. Now the only possible way to accomplish this was by raising the other end.
It occurred to him that he might, by so attaching the rope as to bring the ladder across the window frame, lower himself hand over hand to the floor of the attic. But in doing so, he must have left the ladder there to show their pursuers in the morning, not merely the way they had gone, but for all he knew at this stage, the place where they might then be still in hiding. Having come so far at so much risk and labor, he was determined to leave nothing to chance. To accomplish his object, then, he made his way down to the very edge of the roof, sliding carefully on his stomach until his feet found support against the marble gutter, the ladder meanwhile remaining hooked by one of its rungs to the sill of the dormer. In that perilous position, he lifted his end of the ladder a few inches, and so contrived to thrust it another foot or so through the window, whereby its weight was considerably diminished. If he could but get it another couple of feet farther, he was sure that by returning to the dormer he would have been able to complete the job. In his anxiety to do this and to obtain the necessary elevation, he raised himself upon his knees. But in the very act of making the thrust, he slipped, and clutching wildly as he went, he shot over the edge of the roof. He found himself hanging there, suspended above that terrific abyss by his hands and his elbows, which he had convulsively hooked themselves onto the edge of the gutter, so that he had it on a level with his breast. It was a moment of dread, the like of which he was never likely to endure again, in a life that was to know many perils and many hairbreadth escapes. He could not write of it nearly half a century later without shuddering and growing sick with horror. A moment he hung there gasping, then almost mechanically, guided by the sheer instinct of self-preservation, he not merely attempted but actually succeeded and raising himself so as to bring his side against the gutter, then continually, gradually, raising himself until his waist was on a level with the edge, he threw the weight of his trunk forward upon the roof, and slowly brought his right leg up until he had obtained with his knee a further grip of the gutter. The rest was easy, and you may conceive him as he lay there on the roof's edge, panting and shivering for a moment, to regain his breath and nerve. Meanwhile, the ladder, driven forward by the thrust that had so nearly cost him his life, had penetrated another 3 feet through the window and hung there immovable. Recovered, he took up his spontoon, which he had placed in the gutter, and assisted by it, he climbed back to the dormer. Almost without further difficulty, he succeeded now in introducing the ladder until of its own weight it swung down into position. A moment later he had joined Balby in the attic, and together they groped about in the dark until, finding presently a door, they passed into another chamber, where they discovered furniture by hurtling against it. Guided by a faint glimmer of light, Casanova made his way to one of the windows and opened it. He looked out upon a black abyss, and having no knowledge of the locality and no inclination to adventure himself into unknown regions, he immediately abandoned all idea of attempting to climb down. He closed the window again, and going back to the other room, he lay down on the floor with a bundle of ropes for a pillow to wait for dawn. And so exhausted was he, not only by the efforts of the past hours and the terrible experience in which they had culminated, but also because in the last 2 days he had scarcely eaten or slept, that straightway, and greatly to Balby's indignation and disgust, he fell into a profound sleep. He was aroused 3.5 hours later by the clamors and shakings of the exasperated monk, protesting that such a sleep at such a time was a thing inconceivable. Balby informed him that it had just struck 5.
It was still dark, but already there was a dim gray glimmer of dawn, by which objects could be faintly discerned. Searching, Casanova found another door, opposite that of the chamber which they had entered earlier. It was locked, but the lock was a poor one that yielded to half a dozen blows of the spontoon, and they passed into a little room, beyond which, by an open door, they came to a long gallery lined with pigeonholes stuffed with parchments, which they conceived to be the archives. At the end of this gallery they found a short flight of stairs, and below that yet another, which brought them to a glass door. Opening this, they entered a room which Casanova immediately identified as the ducal chancellery. Descent from one of its windows would have been easy, but they would have found themselves in the labyrinth of courts and alleys behind St. Mark's, which would not have suited them at all. On a table, Casanova found a stout bodkin with a long wooden handle, the implement used by the secretaries for piercing parchments that were to be joined by a cord bearing the leaden seals of the Republic. He opened a desk and, rummaging in it, found a letter addressed to the proveditor of Corfu, advising a remittance of 3,000 sequins for the repair of the fortress. He rummaged further, seeking the 3,000 sequins, which he would have appropriated without the least scruple. Unfortunately, they were not there. Quitting the desk, he crossed to the door, not merely to find it locked, but to discover that it was not the kind of lock that would yield to blows. There was no way out but by battering away one of the panels, and to this he addressed himself without hesitation, assisted by Balbi, who had armed himself with the bodkin, but who trembled fearfully at the noise of Casanova's blows. There was danger in this, but the danger must be braved, for time was slipping away. In half an hour, they had broken down all the panel it was possible to remove without the help of a saw. The opening they had made was at a height of 5 feet from the ground, and the splintered woodwork armed it with a fearful array of jagged teeth. They dragged a couple of stools to the door, and getting on to these, Casanova bade Balbi go first. The long, lean monk folded his arms and thrust his head and shoulders through the hole. Then Casanova lifted him first by the waist, then by the legs, and so helped him through into the room beyond. Casanova threw their bundles after him, and then placing a third stool on top of the other two, climbed onto it and, being almost on a level with the opening, was able to get through as far as his waist, when Balbi took him in his arms and proceeded to drag him out. But it was done at the cost of torn breeches and lacerated legs, and when he stood up in the room beyond, he was bleeding freely from the wounds which the jagged edges of the wood had dealt him. After that they went down two staircases and came out at last in the gallery leading to the great doors at the head of that magnificent flight of steps known as the Giant Staircase. But these doors, the main entrance of the palace, were locked. And at a glance Casanova saw that nothing short of a hatchet would serve to open them. There was no more to be done. With a resignation that seemed to Balbi entirely cynical, Casanova sat down on the floor. "My task is ended," he announced. "It is now for heaven or chance to do the rest. I don't know whether the palace cleaners will come here today, as it is All Saints, or tomorrow, which will be All Souls. Should anyone come, I shall run for it the moment the door is opened. You had better follow me. If no one comes, I shall not move from here, and if I die of hunger, so much the worse." It was a speech that flung the monk into a passion. In burning terms, he reviled Casanova, calling him a madman, a seducer, a deceiver, a liar. Casanova let him rave. It was just striking six. Precisely an hour had elapsed since they had left the attic. Balbi, in his red flannel waistcoat and his puce-colored leather breeches, might have passed for a peasant. But Casanova, in torn garments that were soaked in blood,
presented an appearance that was terrifying and suspicious. This he proceeded to repair. Tearing a handkerchief, he made shift to bandage his wounds. And then from his bundle he took his fine taffeta summer suit, which on a winter's day must render him ridiculous. He dressed his thick dark brown hair as best he could, drew on a pair of white stockings, and donned three lace shirts one over another. His fine cloak of floss silk he gave to Balby, who looked for all the world as if he had stolen it. Thus dressed, his fine lace hat, with point of Spain on his head, Casanova opened a window and looked out. At once he was seen by some idlers in the courtyard, who, amazed at his appearance there and conceiving that he must have been locked in by mistake on the previous day, went off at once to advise the porter. Meanwhile, Casanova, vexed at having shown himself where he had not expected to see anyone, and little guessing how excellently this was to serve his ends, left the window and went to sit beside the angry friar, who greeted him with fresh revilings. A sound of steps and a rattle of keys stemmed Balby's reproaches in full flow. The lock groaned. "Not a word," said Casanova to the monk, "but follow me." Holding his spontoon ready, but concealed under his coat, he stepped to the side of the door. It opened, and the porter, who had come alone and bareheaded, stared in stupefaction at the strange apparition of Casanova. Casanova took advantage of that paralyzing amazement. Without uttering a word, he stepped quickly across the threshold. With Balby close upon his heels, he went down the giant staircase in a flash, crossed the little square, reached the canal, bundled Balby into the first gondola he found there, and jumped in after him. "I want to go to Fusine, and quickly," he announced. "Call another oarsman." All was ready, and in a moment the gondola was skimming the canal. Dressed in his unseasonable suit, and accompanied by the still more ridiculous figure of Balby in his gaudy cloak and without a hat, he imagined he would be taken for a charlatan or an astrologer. The gondola slipped past the custom house and took the canal of the Giudecca. Halfway down this, Casanova put his head out of the little cabin to address the gondolier in the poop. "Do you think we shall reach Mestre in an hour?"
"Mestre?"
quoth the gondolier.
"But you said Fusine."
"No, no, I said Mestre, at least I intended to say Mestre." And so the gondola was headed for Mestre by a gondolier who professed himself ready to convey His Excellency to England if he desired it. The sun was rising, and the water assumed an opalescent hue. "It was a delicious morning," Casanova tells us, "and I suspect that never had any morning seemed to that audacious, amiable rascal as delicious as this, upon which he regained his liberty, which no man ever valued more highly." Please join me next time for another exciting story here on Thrilling Tales of Adventure.